I'm Gary Lewis.
I'm Tim O'Regan.
I'm Karen Grathberg.
Mark Perlman.
And we are the Jayhawks. And you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiblett, and you are listening to episode number 183 of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. First off, I just want to thank everybody that responded to my question in last week's intro about who is singing the second song in the Walking the Floor theme. And really, I should have known this. It's Vern Gosden doing Set 'Em Up Joe. And I got Twitter shamed quite a bit for not realizing that. But I think the reason that I didn't figure it out is because I was thinking it was somebody doing a version of Walking the Floor. And I went back and looked through, you know, my record collection for that. And so, yeah. Anyway, I'm reading your emails now, people. So I'm getting all those mean comments to the Walking the Floor podcast at Gmail account. Went through, read quite a bit of them, actually. Cleared it out. Which I have never done. I've never read those emails at all. And there's a lot of spam in there. There's a lot of people saying one thing or another. And a lot of people submitting guest request suggestions. And I got to tell you that the number one guest request out of anybody, and it wasn't even close, was Mr. Corb Lund. And I'm happy to tell you, the listeners, that I interviewed Corb Lund yesterday. I'm going to be posting that soon. The long overdue interview with Corb Lund, the number one most requested Walking the Floor guest by real Walking the Floor listeners, Corb Lund. Also, if you haven't heard, we of Foo Fighters ilk each did like these Apple Radio shows that you can listen to on Apple Radio, obviously, kind of around the new record release. And we each did our own little show, kind of your own little life story and musical story and all that. And I enjoyed doing mine, but I also got to sit in with Pat for his, and that was a lot of fun, man. I've been wanting to interview Pat for years on this podcast and never have. And it's kind of like, you know, it scratches that itch. He really tells some great stories about his early days and all that kind of stuff. So make sure you go check it out. It was really fantastic. There's also Foo Fighter Radio over on Sirius XM, where we also all did shows. Mine is a glam rock featured, our glam rock focused show that's going to come out, I think, on the 25th of February. And that was so much fun that I recorded a second show. I don't know when it's going to come out, but at some point I did a Guitar Hero show that's like twice as long and goes really in depth into more of the hard rock, heavy metal years of my record collection. Anyway, let's sell some stuff. Did you know that Zounds.com has been around since 1996? If not, it all started way back when as a small retail shop and has since grown to become one of the biggest and bestest online musical instrument retailers on earth. That's right, Zounds.com. If you need something musically related, get over there and get yourself some Zounds.com stuff. Picks, strings, guitars, whatever. Outboard gear, whatever you want. Just get it. Zounds.com. All right, let's get to today's interview. All right, so I interviewed the Jayhawks way back at the end of July. My apologies for letting this one kind of sit around and get a little dusty. At the time, they had just put out their latest record, XOXO. But they've been a band for a very long time, and we had a lot to cover. It's pretty rare that I interview an entire band, so that was kind of interesting. I'm always interested to see how, like, a whole band kind of vibes off each other, because normally when you're doing these interviews, you're just talking to the lead singer or whoever, you know, one person, one representative from the band, so that was kind of cool. Anyway, you've waited long enough for this here interview. This is Gary, Tim, Karen, and Mark from the Jayhawks on Walking the Floor. I'm gonna guess, considering that you guys just put out a new record in this strange time where nobody can tour, I'm guessing you're doing a lot of this sort of thing, and probably like me, you're probably sick about talking about the coronavirus and the weirdness of it all. But what have you guys been doing during this break? Are you doing any interesting, you know, even non-band related stuff during all this downtime?
I'm not.
You guys are waiting for me, aren't you?
You know what? I'm doing a lot of gardening. My garden looks the best that it's looked in about 15 years. And I just got back from I wouldn't call it a stag head party, but it was a pre-wedding thing with a couple of my kids. It was great. We went up north.
Let's talk about that.
It was so much fun.
I want to talk about your gardening, because I got to tell you, right at the beginning of the lockdown, I thought, you know, I'm finally going to really figure out how to garden. And so and my youngest son planted a bunch of stuff. And it's all legal. It's all legal. Well, as far as I know, he might have a secret stash somewhere like my older brothers did. But I don't know. But it's funny. I have tried and tried over the years. I just do not have a green thumb. And I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
I think Miracle-Gro works for a lot of people.
I'll give that a shot.
Yeah, it helps it along. I think it's a lot of maintenance. So the big thing is if you have the time, and it's a constant weeding process. Also, I have a friend who works for chocolate.
Oh, that comes in gardens for chocolate?
Yeah.
Oh,
no. Uh-huh. And that's great. It's company, and it becomes less of a chore and more of a get-together. Plus, there's accountability there. Like, oh, man, I have to go outside now because Carol's going to be here in 5 minutes.
Plus, you have to go to the store to get some chocolate. So it's like, yeah.
Exactly. I have to do that as well.
Keep moving.
Yes.
Legal chocolate?
Yes,
exactly.
Yeah.
What are you growing?
Yes.
Well, I'm obsessed with
We're growing. We have a whole chocolate batch going. It's fabulous.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We just garden for hours.
What about the
rest
of you?
I've been doing some stuff. Pardon?
Well, me and Mark are going to go golf on Thursday.
Oh, cool.
With a couple people. So that's kind of exciting.
I
want to
grow, but I hurt my ankle. So my son is getting a glimpse on what it's going to be like in the next coming years of taking care of an elderly parent. Basically, you know, he has to go back to school pretty soon, but I'm trying to keep him here because I can't walk very well. My dogs pulled me off of a railroad track that I was walking over, and I slipped and turned my ankle. So I'm kind of relegated to not doing much, but I have been producing and recording my son's record, who's he's been writing, and he's got really cool songs, and so we're making his record right here in this little studio. And
let's talk about that a little bit. You know, as I mentioned, I have several young sons myself. Not one of them seems to have caught the music bug, or at least not one of them really wants to play or be in a band or anything like that. I mean, I think it's part of it's like it's just such a different time than when I was a kid and where that was all the rage, and it's just not now. But what did you do as a parent, or what did you not do that has led to your son taking an interest in it?
Well, I think it was because I didn't do that much. I mean, I certainly got him piano lessons when he was young, and he took the 6 years of piano or whatever, and then he kind of drifted off. He's really a painter, you know. He's a fine arts major at BU, and he's a fabulous painter. But he just started, I guess, by osmosis. He has kind of similar taste that I do, kind of old man taste. He likes things like Radiohead and stuff, but he also likes old British folk, and you know, Moby Grape is, you know, one of our favorites, and Skip Spence, and a lot of weird, kind of somewhat obscure stuff, weird stuff. And I think he just started. He's like me, just started playing, and just got obsessed with it. It's only been in the last few years, and just this year he started writing. He's written a lot since the quarantine. And he's just started playing. I have this streaming show, shameless plug, called The Shit Show on Sundays at 3 p.m. Central. Tune in. And he's been joining me on those, and he's kind of become the star of the show. And he's started playing some of his originals. So we've got about 8 or 9 down, and going to keep going at it. So I don't know. You know, I definitely didn't push him, especially on the guitar. He just started playing. And
do you give him tips, though? Are you like, hey, man, check it. This is a diminished chord. This is cool.
No, see, I don't know that stuff, Chris. He knows a little bit. I don't know. Mark Perlman knows this stuff, but I don't know music theory. I mean, I kind of do barely, you know, scales and what, but I don't know diminished. I don't know the names of stuff. Like Karen knows that too. Tim,
I'm I don't either, Gary. And if I did, I'd probably have my own band.
Really?
Really?
I also noticed that all the cool kids on the Zoom have, they have their tools in the background.
I'm changing my
let me see here.
Oh, I like that view. Nice plants. Yeah,
I like that.
Great plants. You know,
this is these I are props, of course, in my studio. This is I don't use any of this crap. You know, it's just
it is
to look rootsy.
That's just that's a green screen back there behind you.
Yeah.
what do you guys think? I assume you guys, like everybody else, had, you know, a lot of plans this year that have been completely upended. When do you expect the touring world to get back up and running? And what do you think that's going to look like? Like, I don't want to be too doom and gloom about it, but it's hard for me to imagine at this point, you know, that with, I think there's going to be some sort of collective PTSD, in with people, you know, obviously just not wanting to be in crowds, but I don't think people realize how much when you're on tour, how much time you spend actually interacting with everybody, whether that's like taking selfies at the coffee shop down the street from the gig or like, you know, hanging out at the merch booth or whatever, like that part of it, it's just hard for me to even imagine coming back right now.
Well, it's definitely a good excuse not to go out to the merch table, which is my favorite. Our last shows we played were March 6th and 7th in Brooklyn and one in Northampton, Massachusetts on the 8th. And that was just when it was happening. We were right in New York and Brooklyn, and I remember it was just the beginning of the elbow bumps and, you know, just at the very inception of that. So I don't know what you guys think. I think people are going to take, it's going to take a long time for people to feel comfortable to be in a room, you know, together. And so I don't think that anything's going to happen soon. I wish we could do like a tour of drive-in movie theaters or something and set up and have everybody in their cool pods. But
I saw Brad Paisley actually did that recently, did a couple back-to-back in St. Louis and Nashville.
Yeah.
And it looked like it was, you know, it looked like people were really happy, but it's, you know, it's hard to imagine routing a whole tour that way.
No, I don't think I've looked into it. But I think, we were planning on doing a lot more shows this year because we had scaled quite down to not much. But I kind of decided, I thought, well, maybe we don't need to tour that much. And then we found we missed it. And, you know, I just relocated back to Minneapolis. And, you know, we're going to be around each other more. We could do more. And then all this happened. So, I mean, I'd rather be careful than to rush into it. I know that.
It's a funny thing, you know, as a musician, when you struggle forever and if you get to a point where you can actually make a living at this thing, I mean, I don't know what it's like for you guys, but it's this fear always in the back of my mind. What if it gets taken away? What if it gets taken? Then what? Then what do I do? You know? And it's interesting just as a case study and not to diminish this, you know, massive suffering that a lot of people are going through, but
right.
It is really interesting to, it's just sort of thrust upon us. Well, like this is what that would feel like, I guess. You know, I mean, it'll end at some point, I'm sure. And life will go back to being normal, but it's
maybe
weird. It's been this sort of exploration of like my biggest fears and neuroses, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's going to be a while also, because even if they have a solid plan to make most people feel comfortable, I think there's always going to be an element of people who are not comfortable, period. You're not getting me to go inside with other people. I mean, even if there's social distancing, I imagine there'll be an element who will even take longer to feel comfortable. But I don't know.
A lot of people have the fear of the vaccine now. Yeah.
Right. There'll be that.
A lot of people might not want it.
Sure.
Because it's rushed, and so there are some conspiracy theories. I don't know if they're conspiracy theories, that it's a way to kind of wipe people out. I don't know. It's so very interesting.
That's right. The whole thing's been dreamt up by the feds, man.
Oh, you said that word.
Well,
let's talk about something more uplifting, your new record and the making of it. It sounds like a really wonderful experience, sharing a house together at the studio and cooking and drinking wine and it's
cuddling.
I mean, some of the quotes in your bio, it's like not the way that a band that's been together for a really long time, it's not the way you would expect a group of people that have been playing together for a long time to talk about each other, but it sounds like it was like this wonderful experience. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Tim.
And Mark. I'm hogging the.
Well, it was fun, and almost the hanging out in the house part was funner than the recording. But I'm kidding. But it was just really convenient, and it's a beautiful property. I don't know if you've ever been there. It's out in the woods, and
no, I've seen pictures.
It's relaxing, and it's a really nice setup to make a record. I'd like to go back down there.
And the studio's Pachyderm for people listening that don't know. But what are some of the? I know that's like a legendary studio, especially like tied into the Minneapolis music world. But what are some of the big bands that are big records that have been made there over the years that people would know?
I don't know. I know Nirvana.
In Utero was made there.
Right. Golden Smog made a very well-known record there. was that mainstream?
Down by the old mainstream. And the EP.
And Soul Asylum.
PJ Harvey.
PJ Harvey.
I think, what's his name? From Shellac. What's the producer's name? I can't think
of. Oh, Albini.
Albini kind of became... That became kind of his Chicago North for a while. And then it fell into disrepair and it was bought by somebody who brought it back up and made it great. And then he passed away, but they kept it going. And it's much better than it was maybe 10, 15 years ago.
Oh, really?
But then we also recorded at Flowers Studio, our friend Ed Ackerson's place who passed away shortly before we started the project, and that's a great studio right in Minneapolis that's been around forever.
did you self-produce it or who produced it?
Yes.
Okay.
We did. We're not in position to hire a big time. Those days of hiring the big producers that we did in the 90s is kind of gone right now.
Let's talk about the songwriting. I read that that you guys shared songwriting duties a lot more, and even vocals, which you've all done in the past with Jayhawks Records, right? So how did this differ from that? Was it something that just kind of happened, or was it like a sort of a stated aim of making the record?
It started, you guys take it from here. It started with me. I had just finished making a solo record in my little home studio. And I hadn't been writing specifically for the Jayhawks. But that was compounded by the fact that for years, it's bothered me. The band has never really complained. But that we'd play a show, we'd play like 20-something songs, and I'd sing 99% of them lead. And we have fantastic singers in Tim and Karen. Mark... to a lesser extent, but Bill has come
into his own. Oh my gosh, I've been demoted.
But he's a fabulous writer, and his singing on this record is impressive, let's put it that way. But people, when Tim would get maybe two songs, if I was lucky, to piece two songs together, maybe a cover, Karen might get one song once in a while when you did Last Cigarette, but and it was like people loved it when they sang, and I liked it. I liked the variety, like the band. You know, you'd have Richard Manuel would sing a song, and Devon would sing a song, and Robbie hopefully wouldn't, but Rick. So I just liked the idea, and I thought, well, maybe this is the perfect time to kind of say, what do you guys have? And it wasn't just like, okay, everybody gets this number of songs and everybody's going to be nice. wasn't going to be that Mardi Gras record or whatever it was, the CCR record. But it was, you know, the songs were strong. It's always the song wins out as far as we're concerned. So as long as we have strong, whoever has the strong songs, you know.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned that CCR record, and then I think like a more recent example might be like a band like Oasis, that it's sometimes the thing that happens right before a band breaks up.
Is that your son there?
Henry. Oh, the dog?
You got the dog? I think your dog and your son maybe just walked
by. Yeah. Lucia's here. Come here, Lucia. Want to be on TV? Let's see. He's got the crazy eyes. He's got the two-colored eyes.
Oh, no.
Hey,
Lucia.
Hey, Lucia.
You should have named him David Bowie.
Yeah. I
know. Hey, buddy.
Hey, buddy. We have another one here, too. Lex, you going to take him out?
Yep.
Oh, my ankle hurts again. That's all I have to do when I want something done. I'll get it out. That's okay.
That doesn't work.
Yeah, you're talking about CCR?
Yeah, well, I'm just, you know, what I was going to say was that oftentimes everybody contributing is like the last thing that happens before a band breaks up. But it sounds like it's like the exact opposite with you guys. Like you found some kind of happy balance with it all. And so I'm curious about that, because collaborating with your bandmates is like, can be wonderful, but it can also be super daunting when that's not the, you know, like when you have a band that's been around for a long time and that's not the way things have been done generally. So I'm wondering how that was for everybody, like bringing in ideas and half-finished ideas. And, you know, that's revealing for me anyway. It's like it can be a very insecure process. So how was it for you guys?
Well, you know, it was a stated effort on Gary's part. So, you know, everyone approached it, you know, with some enthusiasm, and there was no competition. It was kind of a group thing. I mean, we each had our individual songs, but everybody wanted everyone else to succeed, you know, and get songs on there. And I think, you know, it was like a community thing.
Yeah, we'd sit in a... I'd come into town because I wasn't living here at the time. I was in North Carolina. And I'd come in and for a week every month starting last April, or this year ago, April. Okay. And we'd kind of go around in a circle. You know, I'd start usually and play a song. We'd record it. People would make comments, maybe contribute and maybe not. And then we'd go, Karen, what do you have? And we kind of go around the horn. Recorded all this stuff, and then we, over a period of 6 months at least or something, and then kind of in a democratic way, we assembled what were the songs we thought were real songs, and then we all kind of voted a bit, and wasn't perfectly that way, but it was kind of we definitely polled each other to see what people liked, and people are pretty selfless. They usually didn't vote for their own selves.
I mean, how much editing do you guys do with your songwriting? Do you sort of demo and demo and demo till you get it where you want it to be?
I think it's different for each person. For me, no. I'm almost lazy in the way that I like the first, because there's demo love, of course, and you know, sure. and I like to keep it kind of new and not have demoed it to death. Maybe we should demo more, maybe be bigger. But no, I don't think so. I think, Tim, you work differently than I do.
Yeah, I was guilty of the demo love because the songs are old and I got used to hearing certain things, so I'm guilty of that. Mark was really good about, from the beginning, he was always wanting to do like group creations, if I recall. He was into that from the beginning. Mark.
Yeah, I mean, it's just everybody kind of works, has a different way of working, and I think because I don't search out, you know, the lead vocalist on anything I bring in,
I think that, like, if you're going to have somebody else sing your song, they should have some kind of feeling of ownership of that song. So having them contribute to the writing, I think, makes a song that much, you know, more interesting to everybody. I did it.
So we got handled. You handled us.
Gosh, you were so slick about that.
I don't understand what Tim just said, but I made a record, just a little EP for, you know, just for fun with a friend of mine who's this woman, Janie Winterbauer, who's a great singer. And I was always pushing her to, you know, change lyrics or add lyrics or add her own parts, just because I felt like if, you know, she was involved in the songwriting process, she would, you know, put that much more interest into singing the song. So that's kind of the way I look at collaborating. But that's just for certain kind of songs. Some songs that doesn't work. And you just kind of know right away, I think, if a song works, you know, with somebody else's involvement or not. And this record kind of came, the songs all came from different genesis, I guess you'd say. Gary, you know a better word for that?
Well, would it be a plural for genesis? Would it be genesi or genesis?
Genesee.
Oh, remember that awful beer, Genesee? Remember Genesee beer?
Well, Gary, do I assume that you would know Greek?
No. Greek. Oh, because I'm a wordsmith, verbal jockey.
But the genesis comes from the Greek, so I thought.
Oh, yeah, because I'm Greek and Irish.
Anyways, I don't remember what I was talking about.
A fucking potato eater is what you call me.
What?
If I remember. But I will say Mark was always stressing that they weren't his song or mine. They were our songs. I like that, Mark. Because I said, well, you know, your song. And he was like, no, they're our song. They're still Jayhawks songs. So I think that was... It was the hardest record I think I've ever been a part of, other than maybe Hollywood Town Hall, which had its own issues. But just because there's so many,
The hardest record.
Yeah, because there's so many moving parts. There's so many different chefs in the kitchen, so to speak. There's so many different, and whoever brought the song in initially, the idea kind of was put in the hell, you know, like
right.
When we were recording it.
You produce your own track.
Kind of. I mean, we all, and I was the executive producer, which means I was like the restaurant manager. I didn't make any, you know, more money than the waiters, but I had to do more bookkeeping work, like keeping us on time. It's something I really don't want to do it again, but it's just like keeping it going. But everybody, as far as the sound and what the take was, good, they each took ownership depending on who brought this song idea in initially. So that made it more difficult, and it was I wasn't really confident it was all going to hold together until we got into the sequencing and mixing, because it's, you know, that just a lot more going on from different sources.
Well, let's talk.
The recording process itself wasn't difficult. It was complicated, I think, is a better word to put it. But it wasn't like we were struggling to get things done.
Well, it sounds like, you know, from the stuff I read, that you guys came out of it in a really good place, and that's kind of
But that's gone now.
Yeah,
that was there. We're back.
Yeah, love these Zoom meetings, so we don't actually have to be close to each other.
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about everybody. Maybe one by one, you could give me the brief sort of this is your life, your own personal history, like where you grew up and sort of how'd you get the music bug, and what were you all doing sort of pre Jayhawks?
Whoa. Karen?
Yeah. I knew I should have. Let's see. I was born.
I was born in a little shack.
Yeah. No.
Tell them where you're from, Karen. I think it's the
coolest. I'm from a town on the Canadian border, International Falls. And
What's it called? America's
Refrigerator? No, it's the Icebox Nation. You know,
Icebox for a while.
Yeah, there was a year where we had a little competition from Fraser, Colorado, I think, and they, you know, I think they recorded Low Temps in the Winter and duked it out, and I believe we won. So, but you know,
Thunder Bay was the Icebox Nation.
No, sir.
No, I stand corrected.
You stand corrected, and but I will say there are places like. There are other little hamlets around that don't have weather stations that perhaps get some deeper wind chills, but you know, they don't. Oh, you got to, you know,
claim it, just own it.
You got to be on the map to get the prize. So, yeah, and musically, I don't know. I gravitated towards a piano for some reason. I did have a guitar and wanted to do that, but apparently, doing both was just not really going to happen. So, I mean, I didn't get lessons for a long time. So I kind of just started playing by myself and watching people. And yeah, and it's very boring. So whoever made that sigh there, what was the question?
I was just trying to get a sense of like where you guys all from and what
I was in a country
band together.
I was in a country blues trio. That was probably the first real band I was in. And then I was in a couple of country bands. And then the Jayhawks needed a keyboard player. And I just got lucky, you know.
I happened
to be available.
we walked in and scouted you, the Ranch Hounds.
Yeah.
Which also had Eric Haywood in it, if you know Eric Haywood. A steel player played with Ray LaMontagne. He's played with the Pretenders. He's played with us. He's played with a lot of people.
Alejandro,
yeah. Fantastic.
Elvis Costello, right? Or was it
Elvis Costello?
Was he in that band?
Pretenders he was, for sure. I don't know about Elvis Costello.
Yeah, I don't know, but I don't think Elvis Costello, but I don't know.
Yeah. I'll ask Elvis when I see him next week.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Mark, do you want to go next? Can we go around the horn?
Yeah.
Gary. I was born in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Nice tone.
Thankfully, one of the few things my parents.
My podcast listenership in Florida just went off a cliff.
Yeah. So did his relationship with his parents.
You know, if I was in Florida, I might not be talking to you right now. I might be in the hospital. So
true.
True.
They immediately took off from Minneapolis and, I was raised in a little suburb west of here called St. Louis Park, which is well known for boasting a lot of well-known musicians and
Cohen Brothers,
Tom Wilson, Dan Wilson,
Jeff Lovitch, great kindergarten teacher.
Yeah, Jeff Lovitch. A couple of the members of the Revolution, the original Revolution. And
Johnson Brothers from
there? Johnson Brothers, Craig and Kirk and Kyle. And, you know, it was one of those suburbs growing up in the 60s and 70s where the school system put a lot of emphasis on their music programs. So you were, whether you wanted to or not, you were handed an instrument in third grade and were forced into playing it until you graduated from high school. And I think that had some kind of influence on my being a musician. But I think more so was I was one of those kids who had a transistor radio under their pillow every night when they went to bed.
Hey, me too.
I mean, our generation did that. And,
wasn't it true your first instrument was the old licorice stick?
It was the old licorice stick.
I gotta incorporate that on the next one.
They tried to start me on the bassoon, but my fingers were too small, so they had to
small hands.
Moved on to the big liquor shtick, and I don't know if I could blow. I don't think my embouchure is what it used to be, but
yeah.
I think it was like transistor under the pillow. That kind of.
Yeah. till your parent turns it off in the middle of the night.
Well, my mom would come in there and you know, they always gave me a couple hours before.
Is that it, Mark? You were in the Neglectors, then you.
Yeah, I didn't really. I mean,
you were the guitar player, really, for us. Oh,
no,
for,
no, I'm Gary. You know my history.
No, I don't know. Kind of feeding the fire there a little bit.
I'm just watching you on the big screen. I kind of like to watch that. Well, I really didn't have a lot of bands before the Jayhawks. I played around with people, but I never did anything too seriously outside of a band called the Neglectors, which I had some.
A band called the Neglectors. Good yeah. band name, too.
Great
band.
That's a great band name, yeah.
It's time for a reunion tour. Oh, wait, we can't do that, but you know what I mean.
No.
A reunion live stream.
Until the Jayhawks. And that's, and then I wonder about that, but yeah, go ahead, Tim.
I moved up here from Kansas. I was just being a drummer down there in many bands, like cover bands mostly. And it was in Topeka, Kansas. It was the last place I lived before I moved up here.
Mm.
That was a butt town, so I had to get out of there. Played in some bands up here and played with Joe Henry for a while. And then they, through Joe, I learned about the Jayhawks looking for a drummer in 95, I guess.
When did Jayhawks form? When did you guys form? When did you become a band?
1985.
So
I don't think you were even born yet, Chris.
I was, of course I was born. I'm much older than you seem to think I am.
Okay.
But yeah, like when I think of Minneapolis, obviously there's the much mythologized, like
I know, sorry,
basements and,
it went
and Soul Asylum and all that. Were you guys kind of the next part of the next wave, or were you playing around in bands at that same time when they were all coming up?
As who? As Soul Asylum?
Yeah, like Soul Asylum, Replacements, Husker Du, like that. I you know when it
yeah that all era. Those yeah definitely that was the our era.
Right.
In fact, I lived with Perner for a while. Mark Perlman lived with Perner. You know, Danny Murphy ended up being in the School of Smoke. No, they were all, I remember putting up posters for the Jayhawks outside of First Avenue and looking across the street, and there was Westberg putting up posters for the Replacements. No, that was all the same time. And Prince and all that stuff was happening at the same time. Anyway, Tim, I wanted to, we didn't finish your journey, but
I thought I wrapped it up.
Well, I forget why you moved up here. Was it to work with Paul?
It sounds like it was to get out of Topeka.
It was to get out of Topeka. You know, I wanted to go someplace and, you know, a music town. And I was too much of a pussy to go to L.A. or New York. I was thinking about Austin. But then this friend of mine was aware of what was going on up here. And, Todd Newman. And so we came up here a few times and then stayed and started playing. Met Peter Jesperson and eventually these guys. Peter was working with the Replacements at the time.
What, was he their manager or something?
Yeah, road manager to some degree. I don't know the real details.
Well, maybe. Like early on, you guys were on Twin Tone, right?
Yeah. We're so on Twin Tones.
Like,
because
I'm
curious, we made a bunch of demos. Huh?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm stepping on you.
Well, we made a bunch of demos for a different label. There was interest in us pretty early. And we kept doing these things from Atlantic and IRS, remember IRS? And,
yeah.
A&M to make demos. And they give us money to make demos. And then they could never convince their higher ups. They didn't know what we were doing at the time. Whatever we were doing, Americana or whatever you call it, people didn't really know what it was. So,
well, that's really interesting. You said I was going to get to that. Like you guys came up at a time before that was really even a genre distinction, right? I mean, now there's like this big Americana umbrella that kind of with a lot of things under it, and then there's like a Americana Association, all that sort of stuff, but none of that existed at the time. Like, I don't even think it was referred to as Americana, right?
Like, no, I mean, like maybe roots
country or y'alternative or something like that. But like, what did when you guys finally did go to a major label? what did they expect of you? And did that like lead to any funny, you know, music industry moments of getting stuck on tour with like Great White or something, you know, like just some, like we couldn't find a
wish.
You know what I mean? Like there's nobody to put you on tour with because the scene doesn't really exist yet or what, you know what I mean? Like, did you guys have?
Yeah, I actually, well, we got signed to a very quirky, single, a very open-minded label, Deaf American, which was Rick Rubin's label. And we were signed by George Trakoulias, who became our producer and our A&R guy. He heard us over the phone. He was talking to his old friend Dave Ayers. They had worked at A&M together. And George was working at Deaf American, and he heard our Twin Tone record playing in the background in the conversation. He said, "Where are those guys?" He flew like the next day. He saw us play and he signed us. And we ended up on a label with Andrew Dice Clay, Slayer, Danzig, Wolfsbane, Black Crowes, Andrew Dice Clay, and the Jayhawks. I mean, there were other ones. Eventually, they had the Ghetto Boys and Sir Mix-a-Lot, and
sure.
Four Horsemen. A lot of weird, you know, different. So our label wasn't exactly your standard label anyway. And George really got us. You know, he knew what, I think they thought of the Black Crowes as their new Stones, and they thought of the Jayhawks as their new Birds. And so that was, so we didn't have too much of that. We ended up touring with the Black Crowes quite a bit during the Shake Your Money, not so much Shake Your Money Maker, but Southern Harmony, and that was really cool. I was going to tour with Patty E for 5 weeks. So we never got, not until later did we stuck on some questionable bills.
Like, who were your sort of like-minded peers at that time? Who were the other bands that, like, if you could have picked to go on the road, like who, like Uncle Tupelo, Whiskey Town or something, like who was around at that time?
Well, I don't think Whiskey Town existed when we were start. That was later.
Right.
Uncle Tupelo is a band that kind of followed us around and wanted to jam. And I didn't pay them much attention until Jeff said, "Come see my band at the Uptown," and they were really good. So then we became friends, but we didn't really tour with them, did we?
No, actually it was,
Wilco later on.
Uncle Tupelo came to a show of ours at Cicero's. In St. Remember, was that St. Louis?
Yeah, I have pictures.
That was back when we would do. Anybody got a place we can crash after the show?
Yeah.
So so we all went to Jay's, I think, and stayed up all night. And next time we came through Columbia, Missouri, we were playing the Blue Note, and Uncle Tupelo got on the opening slot. And at some point, Gary and I kind of went, "We should probably go out and listen to him a little bit." And walked out there and went, "Whoa, these guys got something going on." So I remember that was a Blue Note in Columbia, which you played for many, many years, Gary.
Where's my band? Yeah, we skipped over my history. But that's maybe to be dedicated to an entire show.
Please fill us in now.
I'll try to do it quickly. I was born in Toledo, Ohio. Went to all male Catholic schools, Jesuit high school, almost went to Notre Dame, changed my mind at the last minute, decided I wanted to go to a big co-ed school. I came to Minnesota because I had a good architecture program, and I was an architect. I was an architect before I was a musician. I'm a very late bloomer. Shut up. Took piano lessons. My mother told me to take guitar lessons when I was 14 because she thought it would make me popular, like everybody goes to parties and everybody sits around and plays Kumbaya, you know. So, but it did help me. And I didn't get an electric guitar until I was 21, didn't write songs until my early 20s. Wasn't in a band until I was out of college, totally backwards. And then I came here and eventually hooked up with some people, and I got in a band called Safety Last, which is a rockabilly band. We were a really good rockabilly band.
Really? And did you have like the pompadour and the drape coat and all the stuff?
Not quite all the stuff, but I had a bit of a...
Enough of the stuff.
You might want to check it out. A little bit called Safety Last. Struck by Love. You'll see a very funny cover.
Did you make records and stuff?
Yeah, we did. I was the one band guy in the band that had toured when the Jayhawks started. And
I was
kind of the veteran. Yeah. I mean, I was 30 when I joined the Jayhawks, so I was not your 18-year-old guy. So, and that's the rest is history. Okay, I'll keep it at that.
That's
good. That's me.
I'll slip that back into the "This Is Your Life" section, and then you know we'll just continue. Like what?
Tell me about Schnauzer, Gary.
Oh, Schnauzer. Yeah, we decided that was my first band. We were a British cover band. And all we did was very obscure Tom Robinson band, and Quick One by The Who, and a lot of Kinks. And then nobody really took the band seriously except me. But so we just decided to come up with the worst name possible, and we succeeded with Schnauzer.
So what was, can you talk a little bit about what it was like? You guys signed to Def Jam, what, in the 90s, right?
Deaf American,
right.
91, and we, sorry, mixing drinks over there.
Tim, you got some martinis going, or yeah, what's up?
I'm racing right now.
Is that your protein smoothie?
I can hear the ice cream.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's a smoothie.
Yeah, I love it.
With vodka.
Vodka smoothie.
The best kind. Yeah, I'm just curious what your experience was like. It's sort of like that was like the last, that was the dying embers of the old-fashioned record business. You know, I think about it, like I joined the Foo Fighters in 1999. Literally, it was like that was the end. So I got to experience like maybe about 6 months of that, you know? What was your experience in the 90s? Like it was very different. Like it's a very different business model to what it is today.
Mark, maybe you talk about that. You really knew. You're pretty involved with all of the Renees and you know the Didias and
Mindy's.
Nick the dog.
Well, Mindy. Yeah.
Well,
anybody else?
Didia. No, sorry.
Well, the only reason I was hanging out with those guys was because I didn't really have much to do in the studio. While we're recording,
so, you
know, those guys were all doing vocals and whatever they were doing, and I was basically being kept out of there. I think it was just their way of keeping me out of the room. So I hung out with a lot of the label people because I didn't know anybody else in LA. We did a Hollywood Town Hall and Tomorrow the Greengrass recorded in Los Angeles, and that was back in the days of spending 4 months on a record.
Right.
And your entire advance. On that.
Yeah, you're never going to recoup. That's true. Very true.
I didn't learn anything about the business other than what not to do or, you know, learn from the mistakes. But I did hang out with those people. Had some interesting conversations, saw some interesting things. Gary and I spent some time at the Viper Room back in the early 90s.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I meant it less from the perspective of like sordid tales of groupies in excess, but more from just
we didn't have groupies.
But if you want to jump into some of that Viper Room stuff, that's totally fine too. But I'm more from the perspective of like just how the industry has changed so much over the years.
Well, I think that's what I was alluding to.
Like what you're talking about, like with big
right.
Budgets for making records and all that and tour support. Like, what the fuck is tour support? That like doesn't exist anymore.
Well, it was tour support was also a fallacy back then too, because you had no idea that we didn't make any money touring or recording. We didn't make any money during those early American years. Those two records,
really,
the two biggest records, and we didn't make any money because, in fact, our crew was paid probably four times as much as we were a week, but we were just so happy to be out there doing that.
Sure.
But when I got home, I had to go back to a day job. You know, that was just the nature of the business. And we learned our lessons as we got older and kept making the same mistakes on budgeting records and the such. And now that we're in an era of producing our own records and being responsible for all the cost, I think we've gotten pretty good at it. I know Tim is... Tim comes from more of a, because he played a lot of more working bands that play cover bands, that played gigs. So he's very well aware of the finances. So you might, Tim wants to chime in on that. He's more than welcome to.
No, you're doing great, man.
Well, I do kind of miss some of the old machinery, because in the old days you did feel like there was somebody around you supporting you, and whether it was Karen Durcott. Remember Karen Durcott?
She'd come I loved Karen, yeah.
Radio station with an axe, like, why are you not playing this record? You know, you go out to L.A. and you'd have your team, and you'd have the people from the label that you were friends with. And, you know, it felt good. I mean, it certainly, there was excess and waste, and in the long run, maybe it wasn't the best bit, right, Lucius? It wasn't the best bit business model. But I do miss certain aspects of it. And now you're kind of more out there on your own, taking care of your own stuff, which is more, you know, Jam and Nakano is, what's his name? It's a, but
hi, hey, Henry.
Watch out, Bane's behind you.
I'm learning. Yeah.
There's a masked man. How do you guys put your records out now?
Very carefully.
Oh. Do you do like a 30 Tigers deal, or are you on exactly. an indie, or
we do a 30 Tigers deal, just like pretty much everybody, I think, that we're kind of within the same sort of middle class, I guess you would call it, of musicians, and it's a great setup. I don't know how that business model, I don't know how they make money, but apparently they do. And I think that's just kind of the future of the record business, is kind of what they're doing and what we're doing. The distribution, we produce a record and they distribute it, which, if you know, you read about the old days of making records back in the 50s and the 60s, that sort of was the business model back then too. You produced your own records, usually a management company would put up the money for the artists, and then they would try to find a label to distribute it. And I think right. that's what we're doing now.
I just read that Goralnik Sam Phillips book, and it was, that side of it was fascinating. The hustle that guy went through to find artists and record them and to distribute those records was just, it's just unbelievable.
Well, you know, Jake, you know, his son is our manager, right? Peters. Peter's son is our manager.
Oh.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say Sam Phillips' son.
No.
That's amazing.
No.
That's cool. Wow, amazing. So does part of that, do you get like the complete, you know?
I haven't. I need to talk to Jake works. About that. I need to talk to Jake about that. He has given me a couple of books, but not his dad. Yeah, I know there's a whole thing about, and I read about this through David Byrne and other people, the shrinking middle class of the music business. Basically, people who do really well will be fine and continue to sell, make a living. And the people who don't rely on music to make their living, maybe they're just making records and have other jobs, they'll survive. But it's all the people like us in between that are going to have a hard time. And the world is going to lose a lot of great music because the people don't pay for it anymore. And so a lot of people drop out.
Right, and now you can't tour. I mean, that's the one thing left where there was still a dollar to be made is gone right now. And that's, I think about that all the time. How are all these young up-and-comers going to survive? I don't know. I just...
Right. I mean, it's that Bowie quote, right? That used to tour to promote your record, and now you make a record to promote your tour.
Right.
And now, because you make money on touring and merchandise, and now that doesn't exist anymore. So
yeah.
God, I'm getting depressed.
Well, let's end it on that uplifting note. Perfect. Hey, thank you guys so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Mark. Yeah. If you want to get together tomorrow, let me know. I'd love to know.
Oh,
All right, that was the Jayhawks on Walking the Floor. As always, we'll be back in a couple of weeks with a fresh episode. And in the meantime, make sure you get on over to Apple Radio and listen to those Foo Fighters shows. And if that's not enough for you, get on over to SiriusXM, listen to the Foo Fighters shows there too. And we'll see you soon. Adios, amigos!